Session number 8282, Reel 2.
Mr. Dufall, Reel 2.
Flies were the main trouble in Happy Valley. There were no two ways about it. As I previously said, they just bit you and fed on your desert sores if you had them. And if you didn't have them, they still worried you all around the face. We used to take the centre out, the first filled dressings, the covered with anti-flavin, and put these over our faces and our hands to keep the flies off us.
What was anti-flavin?
Well, it was a soap bandage. This was a sort of a thing that you could put near a wound or anything, because if somebody got hit, you took out a first filled dressing and wrapped them up in this. But we used to take the pad out and use it to cover our face and our hands and what have we. Some medical thing. I suppose it was successful at that time. Can't really call. I never got hit. I got hit by flies, but not by anybody else or anything else.
Were there any other complaints or diseases?
No, heat exhaustion was a problem. I remember Badgie Walsh coming down from the OP up at Fort Dargadap. He came down and he was suffering with heat exhaustion and shell shock. And the doctor we had with us was Captain McCullum. I wouldn't say he was crude, but he was a bit rough at times. And poor old Badgie Walsh come down and he was jumping around and the doctor was talking to him, trying to get him to reason or something. All of a sudden he gave him such a slap across the chops and Walsh come back to himself straight away. But to us it looked crude to see a captain hitting another rank. But it done the trick. And if ever you were really feeling weak and low, his favourite medicine was a glass of chargal water or a cup of chargal water and a tablespoonful of salt. You put that, drunk it straight down, this cold, cold water out of the chargal, and you kept it down at the best of possible, and that was the idea, to put salt back in your system.
How did you get heat exhaustion? Just staying in out well, in the sun too much?
By being in a gun position, by being up the OP out in the sun all day long, if you had a long series of shoots. Bearing in mind that at Kerin, we recorded targets from Pip Beer 1 to about Pip Beer 40. So there was always something going on with our gun detachment practically all day long. You might get a stand down for 10 minutes, quarter of an hour. It might even go as long as half an hour. And then you'd be back there again, blazing away, firing one round per gun per minute on a target to keep the Italian from moving. Or you might get up there and fire a round every 2 minutes and increase the range 50 yards or decrease the range 50 yards. Or 100 yards, or something like that. You were keeping the Italian from stopping him mounting the counterattacks on the fort to try and get the fort back off of us. But that was your job. And same at night. You could never get a good night's sleep. It was obvious war was on. But you didn't. You just slept in bits and dribs and drabs. Because so never as you had take post at night, you can't imagine a detachment sleeping behind a gun when you fire about 6 rounds gunfire. The noise is terrific. But I know one chap said he slept through 6 rounds gunfire one night. I never believed him, but he never moved.
When did you go to after Khartoum?
After Khartoum?
Yes.
Well, as I say, we moved through to Kassala, and from Kassala we took the road to Barentu. Now, on the way down to Barentu, the regiment was caught in a wonderful little trap. Or at least not the regiment, but our battery was. The soft vehicles that went on in front, which were what we called the monkey trucks, the signalers' trucks, they were 15 underweight Chevs. And they picked up a lot of these three-cornered spikes in their tyres, which punctured the vehicle, and of course slow progress. The Italian had slung these out on the road. Now, it wasn't a hard metal road. It was like a grey granite road, all loose. And you didn't see the damn things until they were actually in your tyre and your tyre had gone pop. And, of course, when you're moving in convoy like that, you only move along at about maybe 25 miles in the hour or 30 miles in the hour. Not very fast. So it wasn't a case of blowouts. It was just we were getting these punctures. Of course, naturally, then the whole convoy was held up while they changed tyres. God knows where the new ones came from. But they changed tyres and on we went again. And then our next trouble was finding landmines across the road, this road. But you could always tell where they were because you could see where the road had been dug up. And you went in and you undone them. And what they were like two shells, Italian shells, wired up from one side of the road to another in a box. And it was a proper sort of Heath Robertson idea. And all you done, you cut the wire and took the shells and threw them down the side of the road and just carried on. They weren't proper landmines, but they'd improvised, I suppose, doing this. And then, of course, eventually, we got down to Barranto and we turned right off the road, came off the road to right, and went up about 150 yards, and mine was the first gun in. We dropped in action, recorded zero lines, recorded a couple of targets, and then Captain Esmond White, our troop commander, he said, "Well, stand easy, we'll have a meal," and this kind of thing. And whilst we were having this meal, a couple of rounds came whistling over the head of us, dropped on the bank behind us, and one dropped in front. And I said to the net gunner, "You got a bracket on me." And Esmond White, realising that they'd had a bracket, he took the gunners away from the guns, and nothing else happened. So we thought, well, that was funny. They put a bracket on and didn't fire for effect. So he then decided, under cover of darkness, we would shift the guns from that position another 200 or 300 yards to the right. Well, of course, that meant hard work at night because he wouldn't bring the quads up to shift them because he'd make a noise at night. So we had to manhandle them all up there, all four guns. Of course, all four detachments outmove each gun in turn. And we got up there and came the morning as he started to fire, record zero lines again and pick up one or two more targets with his OP. And all of a sudden, there was one holy hell of a shell going on down where we were. They'd slung everything at us. And I should never forget, we came up after it had all finished. We went and had a look to see what had happened 300 yards away from us to our left. And where my gun position was, where my gun platform was, there was a blooming great shell hole. And I always felt very proud of Captain Esmond White after that. He saved our lives that night. And that was our first baptism of fire. From then on, we went on and fired there for about 5 or 6 days, 6 days maybe. And we just kept firing at different targets. And one night, they asked if anybody from the guns would like to go up to the OP and take a meal up to the OP and give one of the signalers a rest up there. So I thought, well, I don't know, Blackmore can take over the gun, I'll go up. So I volunteered to go up there, and I was up there looking through the, what we called Oswald. It's like a couple of rabbit's ears. You look like a periscope, you look in, and the two, what's names, poke up above the ground, and you can see over the ground, you know. And I was looking through this, and somebody said to me, "What's that going on over there?" And now, looking away to me right, it was a beautiful moonlight night, and you could see little flickers. You couldn't make out what was going on. And it wasn't until the next morning when daylight broke that they realised what an I'd come down from the OP then. And the story I got later on was that what we'd been watching that night was the Gwalliers throwing their knives. Now, the Gwalliers are a sister regiment to the Gurkhas. And they throw their cookery just the same as what the Gurkhas throw it. My goodness gracious me, you've never seen such a mess in all your life where they'd left that lot that night. They'd practically annihilated a whole Black Eritrean battalion. They caught him inside the valley. They called for fire from another troop onto the end of the valley, which meant that the rounds were dropping there and holding these people in the valley, and they were coming up and meeting the Gwalliers, and they weren't using rifles, they were using their cookeries. My goodness, never seen anything so bad in all my life.
Can you describe it?
Well, yes, if you can describe an animal being hung up and split down the middle to take the intestines out, that's what these people looked like. Cool, they were in a state. They were cut right the way down the front or right the way down the back. If they were running away, they got them in the back. If they were running towards them or trying to scatter, they got them in the front. My goodness, what a mess. Terrible.
How many bodies were there?
Oh, I don't know. About 150, I think, something like that. It must have been a good 100 there, 150, something like that. Fantastic sight.
How many Gawali dead were there?
Well, there was a battalion of Gawaliers. 6th, 10th Gold Wars. I can't really tell you without looking at the...
Well, it'll be in the record anyway. But were there any Gawali casualties?
Not as I know of. There might have been, but you see, they were drawn. When we saw it, when we saw it was about 2 days later after the... You see, after every battle, you always got nearly always got a chance to go and have a look and see what damage you had done. And, of course, in the process of seeing this, I'd seen what had happened and I'd moved on up into Barrando itself, and we went into a hotel there. All my detachment, Ginger Burton, myself, Blackmore, Judd Hardy, somebody else. We went in, and it had looked as though the Italian had just got up from breakfast and gone. There were still cold eggs and bacon on the on the table, and the plates and the knives and forks and everything left there. Just up there. And the shops in the town or in the village itself, they weren't even locked. You just opened the door and walked in. I had more gym vests and things like that, singlets, out of that shop. That's all we used on the guns. You just went in and out yourself. You shouldn't have done, but you did. I'm naughty to say this, but that's just what happened. And we went on to the airfield there, and there was two CR-2 bombers. That was this three-engine job. It's a two-wing engine, one engine in the center. And the one used to cut in the other, making the most weird sound when it was flying over you. Well, there was two of them, complete with bomb racks, still with bombs in them. And to me, they looked flyable, but they'd just gone and left it. And there was other aircraft on there as well, but it looked as though everybody had up sticks and gone.
This was at Barrento, was it?
This was at Barrento, yeah.
And was the action of the Gawalis against the Eritrean troops at Barrento as well?
Oh, yeah. Yes, that was at Brando, yeah. It was in a gorge, actually, just outside, just before you come into the village. Oh, what a fantastic place that was. It seemed to me that this gorge was the way the Italian was trying to make his way out of Brando. But for the life of me, I can't see why, because he would have had to come through some lines of ours somewhere further behind where our gun position, if he'd have continued along the valley. He would have had to come up behind us. But nobody ever got up through there, at least not as I can recall. I mean, we were up on the bank and we could look down into this valley from our gun position. By walking up on the bank, you could look over. That wasn't a bad action, really, although, as I say, it was our baptism of fire. Something happened that you'd suddenly fire on a target and then the OP would say, stop. Immediately you stopped, you didn't fire any more rounds, you waited a few minutes, and then they give you stand easy, and you went back behind the gun, and you sat down, smoked, had a drink of water if you had it, and, you know, you sort of get a pack of cards out and play cards, or do something until the next round, you know. A lot of boredom brought about by waiting for a target to appear. But then all of a sudden, you wouldn't get one, you get maybe two or three targets, you know, you'd be on the go for a long time. You fire around and you wait and you get a small switch, a small range reset relay, and then you fire another round. Then you'd wait another 10 minutes or so for something else to happen. And so you keep on like this. You never sort of had a real good do. Not like when you got to Karen. You knew that you were going to fire 10 rounds, and 10 rounds you fired. If you knew Dom Freddy's 6th target was 6 rounds within the minute or thereabouts, you got that 6 rounds off. But this Brando thing was much more like you'd do on an ordinary firing camp.
What happened next?
Well, after Brando, we left, and as I say, our next stop then would be Karen. And we went off down the road, and when we came to the place we were going to put our guns in, they said, well, you can't go round there. Tony's got a bracket on that corner there, and we just had to wait until darkness. So we waited, and we took one gun in at a time. And each gun came down. The gun tore, the guy towed us into the gun position, put the tow rope out and pulled us in, and we put it on a platform, and now we were ready for action for anything that might hit us. And of course, when daylight come the next morning, you start looking around and seeing all these fantastic great hills. Now, my God almighty, what are we in for here? But I can never, for the life of me, understand why the Italian didn't bomb us out of Happy Valley, because we were such sitting targets. It must have been sitting targets with them up on top of these blooming great hills and us sitting down there in the valley. And that, no, we had, I think we had a bracket put on us once, and that's about all. Had a minus and a plus. At that particular time, I had a chap called Jepson with me, and we were sitting on the trail waiting for something to happen, and this shell came over and landed, and Jepson suddenly saw, oh, I've been it. And all he had was a little splinter in his wrist, little shell splinter in his wrist. But yet the shell landed about 60 or 70 yards away from us, at least. But he just caught this little splinter in his wrist. Now, horrible sensation, apparently. He thought he'd been killed. But he hadn't. It was only a small wound.
He was a member of your unit, wasn't
he? He was a member of my detachment, actually. He was number two in the detachment.
So you didn't think much of the Italian artillery?
No, not really, because, as I say, they had every opportunity. See, a good OP can always look down on its target. That's the essence of a good observation point, to be able to look down onto the target and see what's there. Well, they were sitting up top looking right down our gun barrels, really. I mean, to fire our gun into the nearest Cameron Ridge wouldn't have been much over about 1,000 yards away. Well, we could hit that with charge one. As a matter of fact, we were putting a barrage up once there for the Camerons to go up and try and take Cameron Ridge. And we fired two or three rounds and we got stopped. And we wondered why. And later we were to learn that as we were throwing the shells on the top of the hill, all the rubble was coming down and hitting the Camerons. Not the shell splinters, but the stones and the things were coming down and hitting them as they were going up. They were getting more injuries through fallen debris than they were from the rifle shots from the Tony up top. He'd literally cut himself into the rocks from the other side. He'd hewn out blooming great gaps in the rock so that he could stand in there and fire at us. His machine gun positions on the pass going where they blew the road up. This was all that held us up. They blew the road up, the Italian, and we couldn't get up through Delagadoc Gorge. Couldn't get up there anyway, because all this stuff. And every time our sappers went up there to start clearing, cross machine gun fire kept them down. So at night they'd go up and have a go and get rid of a bit and have a go and get rid of a bit more, until eventually we tried to single out. And this is where a lot of individual shooting was done. If we found out where a machine gun was, we'd try and roust that machine gun out. But we couldn't, because he was inside the actual rock. He'd made a sort of a strong box out of the actual rock face itself. And it was fantastic to try and get these people out of there. They had a railway line run along the bottom. And every now and then a truck would come out railway truck come out with a couple of machine guns mounted in it, blaze away, and then go back in the tunnel again. Well, you couldn't get at it. It's just this awkwardness. No, they were a ragtime army, really.
Did you ever hit any of the trucks that came out of the tunnel?
No, not as I know. We didn't. We never had. Really and truly, you see, an artilleryman never sees what he hits because it's all his shells are always that far away from him. The only time you see what you hit is when you're doing tank shoots, you know, when you're doing direct fire. But indirect fire, which is lobbing around over the house over there, you wouldn't see what happened on the other side, but the OP would. The OP would know and give you a correction for movement on that. But, it was a hell of a place, was Karen. It was so much to be done. I mean, our troop commander, he shot in 146 guns, apparently, for line. And that's what he got his MC from. He was up the fort for 48 hours shooting all these guns in. He got his MC for that. I was sitting in a gun position one night, and I saw flashing from the fort, and I thought, that looks like a DF target. So I called a GPO over to Tannoy. I said, hey, there's a lamp reading from the fort. And he sort of woke himself up and come out of his daze. Oh, yes, he said, Don Freddy 6. So we had the troop took post, and we fired on Don Freddy 6. And apparently, we were just in time to save one of the many counterattacks on Fort Dolagadot, because if we hadn't got our rounds over, they'd have been under our ammunition. And we couldn't shell too close to Fort because of hitting our own people. And we caught them coming over the plateau at the top. And that was another one. Oh, I believe they made 42 counterattacks on that fort.
What's happened to you next at Cairn?
Oh, nothing much. Only, as I say, we came to the morning of the big barrage, and I think we shifted about 500 rounds that day. Oh, we didn't have to pump some stuff over. You started off, you got a gun program. Now, the gun program consisted of something like this. Target, pit beer 1, 6 rounds gunfire per minute. Well, of course, you had to go somewhere to get 6 rounds. Then you get pit beer 2, and you put pit beer 2 target on, and it might be 4 rounds gunfire, 1 per minute, or 1 per 30 seconds. And then you get something out. And then every now and then, when you were doing a program like this, you'd get a stop and be told to go on to your next program. Each gun had its program, and the program was made out so that one gun would be firing there, one gun would be firing there, another one would be firing there. And all the time, you'd get a different order from the gun position officer. He'd say, number 4, stop. Number 3, stop. Number 1, continue. And so it went on like this until eventually you expended all your ammunition. We started at 5 o'clock, or about 5:30, I think, the crack of dawn, and we finished firing somewhere about midday. And we shifted nearly between 400 and 500 rounds. I can't remember the exact number of rounds we had there, but called up them, and gun pits were full of them. Never seen so much ammunition in all my life. I thought we're never going to come to the end of it. Well, after that, then the white flags started coming out on Sancho, Briggs Peak, everything. White flags fluttering all over the place. And we eventually come up, and we got up through the pass, because they'd, whilst all this gunfire was going on, the sappers and miners had cleared a way just to get the vehicles over the road up into Cairn. And away up into Cairn we went. We stayed up there for about few hours, and then we made off to Ashmara. We waited outside. After Cairn, we went to a place on the main road there called Ad Teclisson. And at Ad Teclisson, we were firing up against a cliff face, and we were only using charge 1 just to sort of drive the odd Italian out of his hold if he was about. But we didn't see anything, but I'd done a guard duty that night. I went up on top of the hill, on top of these rocks, to warned the gun position that if anything was going to take place, that we knew the movement was taking place up there, we'd sort of, and they would lob a few rounds up and make them kick down. But nothing happened that night, only except one of my blokes, Reynolds, slipped down a blooming face, and I had to tear a blanket in shreds, wrap it round me, and let the rest of the detachment hold it while I went down and dragged him up. If I'd have known what it was like in daylight, I wouldn't have went down. He'd hung there all night. Absolute sheer it was. But we got him back up there, and we nestled down for the night. And then the next morning, just to the left of where we went up, there was a whole load of shell come down. Oh, it must have been years forming there, I suppose. And an Italian come down that shell, running like this clappers of hell, with his hands up in the air. He kept himself up from falling, I'll never know. And walking along the road at the back of us was a Marathi soldier with his rifle slung. And this bloke walked in, and somebody told him, "We are prisoner of war, go on with him." And off they went. And there were two or three more wandering down. To about 2 days later, they were coming down that road in their shoes. Nobody was looking after them. They were just walking back to the prisoner of war pen. They were just not worried about the war at all. To them, it was all over and done with. And this was at Ad Teclisan. After that, we moved from Ad Teclisan towards Asmara, and waited around for the biggest part of the morning and part of the afternoon, I think. And then we got a message saying Asmara being declared an open town, and that the 5th Indian Division would do its march through the town. And of course, 1st 5th Field Battery was the battery that went through. And there was a Scots regiment with us, Royal Scots, wasn't it? It's the Royal Scots, 1st Afoot. I believe it was 1st Afoot. There were some bagpipes went through, I know. But one went through, we went right through the town, past the sort of town hall where the salute was taken and the handing over of the town was done with General Heath and, or General Platt rather. And the whole lot was given up. We went down into the station yard, and for once we were going to have cover that night. We had somewhere to sleep under cover. And my God, we were tired. No, we all slept in wagons on the railway yard. You know, just ordinary wagon, slide the door back, get in, go to sleep. And then the next day we were doing maintenance on the guns and the vehicles and getting everything back into order, ammunition wagons reloaded, all the kind of things that go on to make sure that you're ready for your next move. And we were going to be sent out on a scuffle just outside of Asmara. We went out and then came back again. We didn't drop in action or nothing. Whatever it was, some patriots had got tied up and there were no trouble, and we'd just come back in the yard. Well, we stayed there for 3 weeks. 3 glorious weeks, actually. We had a naffy come up and it produced sort of tin fruit.